Yeah, we're going to look at Ruth. one of the first questions I always ask people, you know where the book of Ruth is? Well, it's in the Bible somewhere. Yeah, do you know where? Well, let me look. We're not real familiar with Ruth. I think there may be some reasons for that. As Dick said in his prayer, Ruth is an amazing person, but there's some other amazing persons in that story. And there's also some incredible messages to us about the conditions of the Old Testament and how God works. So let's start out by understanding a little bit about culture before we go anywhere else. Would you turn to Leviticus 25, beginning with verse 25. Leviticus 25. I think it's important to understand the background of what happens in the book of Ruth. And I'm kind of sad that a lot of people aren't here for class that are going to be here for worship, because they're going to miss a lot of the connections between what goes on in the book of Ruth and what culture was doing at that time. Because you have to understand that owning property in the time of Ruth and Naomi is a lot different than owning property today. There were rules that were set up by God for these very primitive people. And let's start out just reading right now. Lena, there's a bunch of kids down there already. I don't know which group. Leviticus 25, beginning with verse 25. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells some of his property, his nearest relative is to come and redeem what his countryman has sold. If, however, a man has no one to redeem it for him, but he himself prospers and acquires sufficient means to redeem it, he is to determine the value for the years since he sold it and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it. He can then go back to his own property. But if he does not acquire the means to repay him, what he sold will remain in the possession of the buyer until the year of Jubilee, and it will be returned in Jubilee, and he can then go back to his property. Wow. That doesn't sound like modern America, does it? Again, that was Leviticus 25, beginning with verse 25, and it was the rules for property for that time. What do you think was the reason for that? Why did God have a rule that said something like that? Terry, you lost here? We're in Leviticus. Okay, 25. Wrong chapter. Okay, that helps. As long as you weren't in the wrong Bible, we're okay. Why would God have a property circumstance like that in the Old Testament? That a guy could sell a property, and then if he came back and had enough money, he could buy it back, and whoever he had sold it to had to sell it back to him. He had no choice. And in fact, we won't go into what Jubilee was about, but eventually the property would come back to him anyway. You got a piece of property. If Bill was living in that situation, he could not get rid of Pitcher Lake. He couldn't do it. It would be illegal by the laws for him to sell his property. Why would God do something like that? Why would that kind of law be put in place? Okay, inheritance is part of it. How had they gotten that property? God gave it to them. And God gave it to them how? He gave each tribe a portion of land, right? And you couldn't sell it to somebody else because God gave it to you. It was against the rules. Now, what happens in Ruth is that we have a guy named Elimelech who dies and who doesn't have an heir. And he still owns the property. And this becomes an issue, as we'll see in just a few minutes. Okay, so that's rule number one, or that's situation number one, the rule of property and the idea of property transfers. Okay, the second issue at this day and time, and applies to Ruth, has to do with women. So let's turn to Deuteronomy 25. a little woman law here. Deuteronomy 25, we're going to start with verse 5. And this has major impact on the story of Ruth. Deuteronomy 25, beginning with verse 5. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, this gets a little interesting, she shall go to the elders in the town gate and say, my husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of the brother-in-law to me. Then the elders in the town shall summon him and talk to him. But if he persist in saying, I do not want to marry this woman, his brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, This is what is done to a man who will not build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled. Well, you want an excuse to spit in somebody's face? There you got one. What's going on here? Why would there be a law like that? Maybe I shouldn't play God here, but I think God had a reason for this. Who's being protected here? The women. It really isn't the brother's name that is the huge issue here. I mean, that's an issue. But why the women, Rose? Why'd you say that? Okay, actually, there were some ways they could own property, but the problem was, in that culture, in that society, at that time, under those conditions, there was no way a woman could survive herself. No way she could make it. Yeah. You go to the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31, and you see about the woman buying a field, and she could do that, but it technically would be in her husband's name. The point is, women were at a huge disadvantage in that culture. And protecting women was a major issue. And you know, you start and you think about it. In today's world, that sounds weird. You know, your wife says, I can do anything you can do. Well, you know, that wouldn't have happened in the day of what we're reading about here. Because it was a very cruel, a very harsh, a very difficult world. And God provides for this. And our failure to understand this has caused some major misunderstandings. Let me take a little side trip here. Turn to Genesis 38 for a minute. This is a story that has been used for the wrong purposes by preachers and by even some religions. There have been some religions who say birth control is wrong. And they use this story to justify that. They also have used it to address issues like masturbation and other situations that deal with sexual behavior. But this is a story about a man by the name of Onan. And in Genesis 38, beginning with verse 8, Genesis 38, starting with verse 8, we have a situation where a guy named Er dies. And his father goes into the situation, and starting with verse 8, and Judah said to Onan, lie with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to produce offspring for your brother. Okay, so what Onan tells Er to do here is to do what we just read about in Deuteronomy 25. Okay, and Onan says, no way. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he would lay with his brother's wife, he would spill his seed on the ground to keep from producing offspring for his brother. What he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, and he was put to death. Now, this has been used to try and suggest that birth control is wrong, because when Onan spills his seed on the ground, when he refuses to fertilize his brother's wife, there's a condemnation. But what is the condemnation for? Is because of what he did? What violation? Of what call? Well said. If the woman was disadvantaged. Actually, this law was in effect long before Deuteronomy. The problem was it wasn't written down until Deuteronomy. And what Onan was condemned for was not the fact that he spilled his seed on the ground, to use the wording that's in this passage, but because his motivation was to refuse to do what God had told him to do. So it's kind of interesting that sometimes this incident has been misused in that way. When Jesus came around, the same issue was being circulated. Let's jump over to Matthew 22 for just a minute and see where that is, and then we'll go to Ruth. Yeah. But he didn't want to have the first one. He just didn't want to do what God said to do. I'm not going to support my brother's kid. He's gone. Won't have my name. Not only that, but... Well, surnames were not used by the Hebrews generally. So, you know, what was Joseph's last name? What was Judas? What was Adam's last name? Adam. They didn't use surnames. If they had a name, it was usually something that described the person. Can you think of an example? Well, that could have been, but most of the time there was something about the person that was that way. How about Esau? Okay, and what did his name mean? It means red. So Esau the Red was his name. Okay? So if there was a surname as such, it described you. Alexander the Great. See, that was still going on at that time. So they didn't have surnames. When did we start having surnames? A little history here. English. And what were most of the surnames? All right, it could be the son of. As a matter of fact, that was going on in Jesus' time, wasn't it? James, son of Zebedee. Okay, that was going on there. In England, though, Smith, where'd that come from? Blacksmith. So a guy was known as John the Smith. Well, that meant John the Blacksmith. Okay. And every one of those names that you go back to, I happened to look this one up. What do you think Clayton was? It was a potter. A potter. That's where the name came. So my name in England would have been John the Potter. Somebody said, I don't like that. Let's call it Clay. Well, let's make it Clayton. He's a mess, so we'll call him Clayton. You know, anyway, the point is, you didn't have surnames as such in that process. In Matthew 22... there's this situation where, starting with verse 23, there's this situation where there's a guy trying to tie Jesus up. And it's kind of interesting that this Sadducee comes to him and he gives him this hypothetical situation. And what he does is he calls on this law that we just read in Deuteronomy 25:5. Teacher Moses told us that if a man dies without having a child, his brother must marry the widow and have children for him. And that's in fact the law, okay? Now, there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died. And since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. And the second thing, same thing happened second and third on down to the seventh. And finally, the woman died. And after the resurrection, whose wife's going to be since all seven were married to her? Boy, there's a ton of assumptions in that one, aren't there? Now, you know what Jesus says here. He says, hey, you idiot, don't you understand that's not what happens when you're raised from the dead? But as we've talked about before, the concept of heaven and hell was not something that was part of the Old Testament in terms of direct teaching. And so Jesus says, you don't understand. But the point I want to make here is that the law of marriage was still going on at that time. So this is the background for what happens with Ruth. And so let's turn over now to look at Ruth. And you probably know the basis of the story. And again, if you're having trouble locating Ruth, because I always did, not knowing much about the Bible, the way I always remembered it was where it was, and it sort of stuck between Judges and Samuel. Okay? It's stuck in there, just a little clip between the two. And there's an interesting situation develops here. And let's just remind ourselves of the circumstance. And I'm going to start with, let's just go ahead and start with verse 1. I'll just read a little ways here. Now, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in a country of Moab. By the way, let's just stop here for a minute. Moab was very much like America. If you had asked most people in Moab who their God was, they would have said none. There was quite a bit of idolatry. There was no strong connection with any one God in Moab, which is neither here nor there, but it is an interesting connection. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi, and the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephraimites from Bethlehem, Judah. That means that he held property in the Bethlehem area. And they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Noah's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and another named Ruth. After they lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Noah was left without her two sons and without her husband. Now, that's a major situation. That's the big problem. The difficulty for Ruth for Naomi is that her husband apparently doesn't have a brother. So there's nobody obligated to marry her directly. And so what happens is that she decides she has to tough it out. This is a really tough situation for her to be in. And that's the background of what happens. So how is a woman like Naomi going to survive? Well, that's what we want to look at in class this morning. And then in worship, we want to look at exactly what takes place in her life. But let's notice a couple of things about Ruth. Let's go over to the third chapter of Ruth to begin with. You know what happens with Ruth and Naomi? Ruth refuses to leave Naomi. And we'll quote this during the worship service. But this is that famous passage that's over in verse 16. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. So that's a very famous passage. Back in my day, there was a singer named Les Paul and Mary Ford that had a song that quoted this directly. So it's been very well publicized in a number of songs and things of this situation. But the question is, how does this get worked out for Naomi? How does God handle this situation? And we won't go into all the background in class this morning because we won't have time to do that. But I want you to notice what she does and how easy it would be for Westerners like us to misread this. Ruth 3, verse 7. Okay? Now, I realize we're skipping a lot of stuff here. We'll get to the stuff we're skipping in the worship service this morning, in the sermon. But Boaz is out taking in the harvest. And in verse 7, again, chapter 3 of Ruth, verse 7, when Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. Okay, now, first of all, in your warped Western mind, what immediately crosses your thinking? No, that's that's your warped, crazy mind. In all of our minds, what do you tend to do with that statement? It looks like some sex is going to develop here. It looks like this is going to be tabloid stuff. And that's what our tabloids say. However, you need to understand something about this situation. A woman's way of making a request involved uncovering a man's garment and covering herself with that garment to ask his protection. Because understand, Ruth has no protection in this situation. As a matter of fact, this is an incredibly dangerous place for her to be. We'll get into that in a worship service. But can you imagine, here's a bunch of farmhands who may not be particularly religious. They're out there harvesting grain all day. And here comes this very attractive Moabite woman. What is likely to happen? Somebody's going to take advantage of her. She has no legal protection. She's not an Israelite. She has no legal protection. And so nothing's going to happen to them. If you read the passages around this, and we'll get into this in worship. As a matter of fact, if you jump back just a couple of verses to verse 22, when Naomi talks to Ruth about this, she says to her, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go in with his girls, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." I mean, Naomi warns Ruth, look out. It's easy for you to get in serious trouble with this situation. So we have to understand that what goes on here when she goes in and uncovers his feet and lies at his feet, that this is not a sexual thing. This is a way of saying, I need your protection. So let's go back now to verse 8. Again, we're in Ruth 3. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." Okay, now, here we have a question of what do we mean by a kinsman redeemer? Well, kinsman, first of all, means that in some way we're related. Now, in this case, it's a very indirect relationship because in reality, this man is related to Naomi. Okay? So it's a very distant relationship. But the other half of it is redeemer. And the redeemer part is what we started out with this morning. Leviticus 25, beginning with verse 25. You remember what we read in that passage? It said that if somebody sold a property, the guy who bought it could come back and buy it back and would pay the original price plus whatever extra money had been involved. This was called a redeemer. So what she's saying to him is, we have a relationship, and what she said by covering herself with the garment was, the corner of the garment was, I need your protection. Now, there's a couple of things that could happen here. One thing that could happen is he could say, no way, and put her at the mercy of whatever happened. He has a choice to make. But look what actually takes place here. Verse 11. "Now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. And although it is true that I am a near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I." Okay, so here's where God is getting into the picture. This guy is related to Naomi, but apparently he's not very closely related. And I could not find any indication anywhere of what his relationship was. He's a distant relationship to Naomi. And there are some other guys that are closer to her, or closer blood related to her, than he is. So he says, there's another guy in the picture here. So verse 15, stay here. I'm sorry, verse 13. So stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he is not willing, I vow that as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it and lie here until the morning. Let me back up one more thing. I'm going to get into this in the sermon, but I can't pass it up right now. I want you to notice something else about Ruth's reputation. If you look back to verse 10 of this passage, after she says to him, spread the corner over your garment since you are a kinsman redeemer, he says, blessed are you, this kindness is greater than the one you showed earlier. You have not run after younger men, whether rich or poor. What's he saying to Ruth? I mean, she and Naomi had a couple of options when she came back from Moab about how they're going to survive. What would one option be? Just speaking in a worldly standpoint. For her to marry somebody else. Now, if you go back to the first chapter, you'll see that this is what Naomi says to Ruth. Go find yourself another husband. And Ruth says, no, I don't want to do that. The other gal, Oprah, that's what she does. But that's not what Ruth is willing to do. So one thing is to find another husband. And you say, well, why didn't she just do it on her own? Because this is not America. This is not 21st century. She doesn't have that option. I don't think young women especially appreciate what Jesus Christ has done for women. Because before Christ came along, women had no rights at all. And this, you gotta survive whatever way you can. And one way women survived was prostitution. As a matter of fact, we're not going to get time to do this, but one of the things that's interesting is to read the story of Tamar. This goes back a little earlier than Ruth. But Judah, who is, a pretty high-fluting guy in Scriptures, Judah had a daughter-in-law named Tamar, and when her husband dies, who is Judah's son, Judah says, okay, if you'll just hang on, I've got another son coming along, you can marry him. And he'll do what the law of retribution says, what Deuteronomy 25:5 says. But when the boy gets that old, Judah welches on it. And what Tamar does is she goes out and dresses as a prostitute and has sex and gets pregnant from Judah. I mean, it's amazing when you look at the Bible and how directly and how honestly it deals with the history of the time. And the child of that was Perez, and Perez is a close relative of Boaz. That's as close as you get to finding out how Boaz is related to Naomi. But it's an interesting story. If you want to read about that, by the way, it's in chapter 38 of Genesis. But it's important to recognize what's going on in this process. So the situation is such that Boaz is not the closest relative, but he says, there is a closer relative than me, and he has first shot at you. You follow what I'm saying? He has first shot at you because he's more closely related to Naomi than I am. Did the woman have anything to say about this? Not at that time. Women were possessions. Women were possessions. And once a woman got into that relationship, she was pretty well stuck with whatever the situation was about. You see what Jesus has done for women in today's world, and you go back and you look at history, you see the difference in the way in which this whole process is taking place. And so she gets up, this is verse 14, she gets up and leaves in the morning, and she comes to Naomi. In verse 10, Naomi says, how'd it go, my daughter? And she told her mother-in-law what had taken place, and he had sent her back with some food. And notice verse 18, Naomi says, wait, my brother, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. Naomi knows the rules. Naomi knows the rules. And we get a picture of Boaz here. Boaz is a man of chivalry. He is a man of morals. He's a man of commitment. He could have taken advantage of Ruth. He doesn't do that. He protects Ruth. And not only that, but he jumps through all the hoops. He jumps through all the things that society requires he do. Anything like that in the New Testament? What are we commanded as Christians to do in relation to civil authority? Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. What else? That's the other half of that. What else? Romans 13. Yeah. We are to render to honor to whom honor is due. Read Romans 13. Render to honor those who deserve honor. Render unto those who are ruling the power that they are given, and so forth. So we're told to do the same thing that he does here. And it's interesting that you put yourself in Ruth's situation. I think Ruth would have probably desired to be Boaz's wife in terms of the respect he had shown her and the way he had treated her. But he doesn't have that ability. And what could happen here is that she could be taken by whatever relative it is, and there's no way to tell how she would be treated by that. So let's see the happy ending of this story, chapter 4. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." Okay, here comes the guy that has first choice on Ruth. He actually has first choice on Naomi's property in accordance with Leviticus 25. But Ruth goes with the property. She's part of the deal, okay? She's part of the deal. So verse 2, Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here," and they did so. And then he said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so, but if you will not, tell me so I will know. For no one has the right to it except you, and I am next in line." Okay, so Boaz says to this guy that's closer to Naomi, "You got first choice. You're going to exercise it because I have second choice." And the guy says, "I will redeem it." End of verse 4. Oh boy, I'll bet Ruth's heart just sunk. And don't you know, I'm sort of reminded of the fiddler on the roof. Don't you know this guy's probably ugly and fat and bald and looks just like me? And here's Boaz, who's a hunk. And she said, oh no, look who I'm going to be stuck with. But Boaz isn't done. So verse 5. I mean, the Bible makes novels look like child's play. Why would you read a silly novel or read People magazine or something when you got a story like this? This is all right. Boaz says, "On the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth, the Moabite, you acquire the dead man's widow." Oh, Boaz says, "Hey, my friend, you're not just getting the property, you're getting a woman too." Oh. "In order to maintain the name of the dead and his property." And at this, verse 6, the kinsman says, "Whoa." I didn't know there was some other stuff in this deal. "Whoa, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it." Well, that's where Boaz wanted to go anyway. And don't you know, Ruth is saying, "Phew, boy, that was close." And so he goes on. And verse 7 is interesting because I don't know who wrote this. I mean, it's part of the inspired word, but isn't it interesting that the Holy Spirit wants us to understand this? "Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one property took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was a method of legalizing transactions in Israel." Why would you take off your shoe and give it? I mean, that's a stinky, smelly old shoe. Why would you take it off and give it to somebody to seal a deal? Is there any logic to that? But why don't you cut off some hair or something? Why would you use a sandal? You can't get from point A to point B without a sandal. Yeah, and it's personal. It's personal. And so this was, I don't know, I couldn't find any reference that said this was commanded by God, but it was a way in which the deal was transacted. And so the next verse, verse 8, so the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself, and he removed his sandal. So the deal is going to be consummated. And it's kind of interesting that the historical value of this is carried right on through in verse 9. So Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahan. And I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahan's widow, as my wife. And in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property so that his name will not disappear from among his family and from his friends, today you are witnesses. So he's jumping through the hoops. And look at the reaction of the people. And the elders and all at the gate said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah. Who are Rachel and Leah? Little review of Israelite history here. Okay. What was the deal there? And so he threw Leah in the ditch and went with Rachel, right? He worked another 7 years, and Leah remained his wife. You know, again, women were possessions. And he loved Rachel. He didn't care that much for Leah, but he loved Rachel. And, you know, you put yourself in Leah's shoes in this situation. He goes on, he says, may you have standing in Ephratah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah. Well, Tamar's the one I was telling you about a few minutes ago, who pretended to be a prostitute and got pregnant with Judah, producing Perez. And so again, she had to manipulate things. Why would they make reference to that terrible story? What's the connection of Tamar to the rest of the Bible? What's, for that matter, what's the connection with Boaz and with Ruth? All right. Yeah, that's a message. Man can mess things up, but God's Word is still true and God still works. But where does this all end up? Because we're almost out of time. Where does it all end up? Cindy? Well, and where are you going with that? What else is in the ancestral line? David. This leads, the child that is born of the relationship between Boaz and Ruth is named Obed. Obed means servant. And Obed is the father of, eventually, the grandfather of David, the king. So what we're seeing here is how this led to David. And it's interesting as you read the rest of this story, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi. Now remember, Naomi is... she's where this whole thing started, and she's the mother-in-law of Ruth from her son's marriage. So they say to her, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons. Boy, you could preach a sermon there for women's lib. Okay. Is better for you than seven sons, has given birth. So Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. And the women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So that's where the story ends. It's an amazing story. I think the message for us is to understand a little more about how Israelite history went on, what the conditions were like in the day in which Ruth lived, and in the day in which Jesus lived, and what a radical difference there is in the Christian system. We can really appreciate how Christ has brought rights to women, status to women, conditions to women that are so radically different than what was present at the time in which this story was written. And we're going to see more of that in today's sermon. Cindy? Okay. That got by me. Okay. Who was Isaac?
The father of Jacob.
Okay. You just missed it by one generation. That's all. That's not bad. Well, I think that's an interesting parallel. I hope that helps a little bit in putting this together. You know, I've been a member of the church for a long time. I don't think I've ever heard a sermon or a class on Ruth. So it was kind of interesting that there's quite a story there and a lot of information. Patty? Yeah, because it's carrying on the family name. And that's why Oman didn't want to do it back in Genesis 38. Now, Naomi was, you know, she's a grandmother. I mean, it doesn't mean that the child was taken away from Ruth. It just means that his identification would be with Naomi's husband. And the whole thing... No, you don't. Because you're a Westerner and you're living in an American culture, and it's difficult for us to comprehend. That's why so many people have trouble with the Old Testament. Because there's some bizarre teachings around this. What a woman could do if someone attacked her husband. You read through that, there's some amazing teachings given there. Well, we're past time, but I appreciate your comments. I hope that is interesting and a little bit of a different picture, and maybe will help with today's lesson.